I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a Friday Film Fest, the career of Robert Altman. But we begin with that Supreme Court decision to do away with most campaign spending limits on corporations and unions. Here in Massachusetts, we just suffered through a torrent of outside ads in a Senate election. Hard to imagine it could be worse, but critics of the decision say, get ready. Conservatives were generally pleased. They called it a vote for free speech. Tom Hamburger is with the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. And Tom, the court ruled 5-4. Some Republicans point out it frees corporations and unions, so money will go to Republicans and Democrats. Your thoughts?
Well, certainly unions have been closely aligned with the Democratic Party, and corporations, the business community, has traditionally been more associated with the Republicans. But if you study the amount of money that's in play or available to spend, the treasuries of corporate America have far more to offer should they decide to play in the political elections, and this court case, Robin, opens the gates wide open for them to participate.
Well, this is confusing to some people because they think that corporations already are participating. For instance, Chambers of Commerce, to pick one example, I think put $1 million into a Republican Scott Brown's campaign here in Massachusetts. They were sort of doing it before, but now it'll be easier?
Let's go back and talk about a little bit of history, Robin. It takes us back to the era when Theodore Roosevelt was president, and there was a sense that corporations, the railroads, the big oil companies, were so dominating politics and dictating policy to lawmakers that a law was passed to restrict corporations from giving directly out of their corporate treasuries to campaigns or candidates. But what has happened presently is that corporations, if they want to play, contribute to a third-party organization, a trade association like the Chamber of Commerce, which, as you said, dumped $1 million into Massachusetts just in advertising in the last few days of the Brown-Coakley race. So there is corporate money that enters campaigns, but it does so through this kind of restricted funnel of the trade associations and their disclosure rules that apply to them and so forth. What the Supreme Court decision says is if corporations want to, they can simply write a check right out of the corporate check registry and run their own ad. It has Democrats fearing particularly that this will send a flood of corporate money into campaigns that we haven't seen before.
Well, in fact, some on the GOP side say, in fact, the only thing it will do is make things more transparent. In other words, if you know exactly who's writing the check and they're speaking right to you, then you get a better idea of who's doing what. But I guess a question is, what does it do for the parties? Some have said that it sort of makes the political party obsolete if corporations or unions can have their own voice directly to the people.
Political parties have been in decline in this country for decades, in part because of the atomizing of our society and also because other groups are participating, taking over the function that political parties once played, like chambers of commerce. The parties now, though, did function as a place that aggregated interests and they flowed into campaigns. I think there's an enormous fear now among the sort of party officials that this will hasten the decline of the political parties. You know, we talked about advertising, but think beyond that. It's also organizing field operations, going door to door, paying for volunteers. There will be an enormous opportunity for someone with a big wallet to come to a candidate and say, vote my way or I'm going to enter your race big time, with not only TV ads, but speaker trucks going through every neighborhood.
In fact, with that thinking, we might not see an onslaught of ads. We might see nothing because the decisions might be made in back rooms, as you said, with the threat of the dollars being spent on a campaign.
One of the fears among the sort of good government crowd and reform advocates, Senator Russ Feingold was talking of this yesterday, is the sort of preemptive cave-in that this will represent, because big interests can simply come and say, vote our way, or we're going to unleash our treasuries on your race.
President Obama said yesterday he'd take up legislation limiting the impact of this court ruling, but we're reading and many analysts saying that because the court ruled on First Amendment grounds, that's going to be hard.
There is discussion on Capitol Hill today about legislation that might be offered to try to restrict the impact of this. Senator Schumer has talked about legislation that would restrict, as the decision allows, coordination between this independent money and any campaign, so that if a major corporation or a union came in, they would violate the law if they talked to the candidate or worked specifically in coordination with the campaign. Another would be to enhance the disclosure requirements. so that any ad that a company paid for would require very clear disclosure and also some kind of acknowledgement, say, on the air of who actually paid for the ad.
That's Tom Hamburger. He covers money and politics for the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. Tom, thanks as always.
Thanks. Good to talk to you, Robin.
Well, now a break from the news.
Attention. Tonight's movie has been MASH. Follow the zany antics of our combat surgeons as they...
Actually, the news always played into films like MASH, which put director Robert Altman on the map in 1970 and launched a career that would transform American filmmaking and span five decades from Nashville, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, to The Player and beyond. And according to a sprawling new book with a cast of characters that rivals an Altman film, as Altman traveled that trajectory, he was both genius and jerk, or as Altman might put it and did in the title of a fake country song, "I'm swimming through the ashes of all the bridges I've burned." The book is called Robert Altman, The Oral Biography. In it, Mitchell Zuckoff talks to the director, who died in 2006, his family, and actors who adored him, Meryl Streep, Keith Carradine, Tim Robbins, along with a couple who didn't, Sam Shepard and Warren Beatty come to mind. Zuckoff is a professor of journalism at Boston University, and Mitch joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Great to be here.
And congratulations. What a read. And in reading it, and you can't put it down, we had some of those same conflicting reactions. You can't help but love this guy, but at times you really don't like him. I mean, how are you feeling as that's what was starting to be revealed to you?
There are contradictory things about Robert Altman. You can love his films and you can not like the man. He was not an easy guy to get along with at times. He had great appetites for women, for pot, for booze. And sometimes the worst sides of him came out in really ugly ways. But we have to judge him sort of over the course of the full 80-plus years and the full 50 films and not focus in just on the less savory sides of him, but they are very much there.
Well, they have to be because they're part of, you know, having to tell his story, and you can't help but love the young man, the young Robert Altman, who travels across country in a convertible and when it snows puts on his aviator glasses from, you know, all the, what, 40, 50 missions he flew in World War II.
Yes.
But then again, there's the drunk who leaves his child with his head stuck in the crib bars on one occasion and tells all his kids, he gathers his children around at another point and says, if there's a choice between making movies and you, I'm going to dump you in a second.
Yeah, Steve Altman, his second son, told me that story. And I remember drawing in my breath when I sat there and heard Steve tell me this story. And he's not a great father, and he admits that. He was about making movies. He was not somebody you would want to emulate as Father of the Year. But Steve Altman, his son, who had to hear that as a young man, made his peace with it over the years.
Right.
And when I saw the two of them together, there was a lot of love between them.
Well, and his wife, Catherine, his third wife, I believe,
yes,
the one that sort of stuck to the end, seemed to make her peace with it as well. Just tell us briefly what her... Such a strong woman, the influence she had on him.
Catherine Altman is in many ways the unsung hero of Robert Altman's life. She supported him through thick and thin, and there was a lot of thin in the early years especially, and even some of the later years. She is a strong woman. She's a proud woman. She was a beautiful, beautiful woman who decided that she was going to throw her life in with him, and she went through a lot with him.
Right. I'm thinking of the time that Faye Dunaway, a potential mistress, came knocking on the door looking for Robert Altman. You know,
that's a good example.
Just one example. But so we've met now some of the characters, and you set the book out. It's very clever. Excerpts from interviews you have with all of these, this huge cast, paragraph after paragraph, so it almost reads like a script. And you break it into three acts. So let's start with Act One. Give us a brief thumbnail. Who's Robert Altman? What shaped him? Where'd he come from?
Robert Altman is the classic American director. He's a Midwesterner, a boy who grows up in Kansas City, a child of comfort. He's a middle-class young man whose father is a successful rogue, but also a successful insurance salesman.
There was a very little difference in those days.
Yes,
sort of
a true
con artist salesman, yep.
And his father, B.C., was a big influence on him. And he was a Boy Scout, and he was a young man who got kicked out of school because of a story involving a blonde, a gun, and a snake.
You have to read it?
He goes off to military school and then enlists in the Army Air Forces because he wants to fly fighters, but they send him in bombers instead.
Well, and the first film that he says made a difference in his mind between a movie and a film his brief encounter. He says it changes his life. What did he mean by movie and film?
He saw Celia Johnson, the star of that film, in these sensible shoes, as he put it, and said, wait a second, there's something different going on here. It's not just the beautiful woman on the screen. He understood that film could convey the inner life of someone, and someone who was not necessarily technically beautiful could come to life on the screen. And that sort of opened his eyes to this idea of what film could do.
Let's listen.
I stood there and watched his train draw out of the station. I stared after it until its tail light had vanished into the darkness.
So here we are. We're still in Act One of Robert Altman. What else should we know from Act One?
You can't overlook his years in the Army Air Forces. This is a guy who is a co-pilot on a big bomber in World War II. He learned how to be fearless as a 19-year-old, something that served him for the next 60 years.
Right. Starting again, still in Act One, when he was doing industrials and commercials, he told off advertisers. He would build these strange Rube Goldberg-like cameras, and then when nobody wanted to drive the car that the camera was attached
That's
to,
right.
He did it. So he took a lot of risks in filmmaking then.
Let's
move to Act Two, 1970 to 1980. Of course, MASH, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Nashville, Popeye. Tell us more about Act Two.
Everything revolves around MASH. And 15 or 16 directors turn down MASH, and he makes this film that is a sensation. It taps into the zeitgeist. It taps into people's thinking about Vietnam, even though it's technically based in Korea.
Let's listen to a scene. You've got Elliot Gould and Donald Sutherland in this MASH unit, medical unit, again, stuck in Korea.
We do have to make certain concessions to the war. We're 3 miles from the front line. And...
yes, but a man can't really savor his martini without an olive, you know. Otherwise, you see, it just doesn't quite make it.
Attention. The Evangelical United Brethren Church has donated 34 hymnals to the 4077th MASH unit. These hymnals are located in the camp library and may be checked out by those with cards.
Elliot and Donald wanted to get Robert Altman fired. They didn't understand what he was up to. He was more focused on the whole atmosphere of what it was like to be in war because he had been in war. They thought it was going to be the old style of filmmaking where the camera is on you, you're the star, you speak until you pause, and then the next guy talks. And they were suddenly blown away by this, and I don't think Donald Sutherland ever quite got it, but Elliot Gould came to understand that this was going to be real.
That's Mitchell Zuckoff. His book is Robert Altman, The Oral Biography. By the way, for listeners here in the Boston area, he's going to be part of a celebration of Robert Altman's work tonight at Boston University. It includes a 40th anniversary screening of MASH at a local theater and a reunion of Elliot Gould and Sally Kellerman and others involved in the making of the film. They'll have a panel with questions and answers. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. And when we come back, more on Robert Altman, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and you might recognize this music from Prairie Home Companion. We'll be back with more in about a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Mitchell Zuckoff, his new book, Robert Altman, The Oral Biography. And Mitchell, before the break, we were talking about MASH and how actors Donald Sutherland and Elliot Gould really didn't get what Altman was doing, having actors talk over each other, improvise, a style that stayed with him through Prairie Home Companion. So what do you think? Was he the actor's saint because he gave them freedom and said throw away the script, as some said? Or did that make him, as some critics said, lazy, you know, more concerned with just the pictures?
I think that is just crazy. I've read that criticism many, many times.
Well, you read it in your book.
And yes, and I even include it in the book because you have to. You have to deal with that criticism, but it's just dead wrong. There's this impression that he just sat back, turned on the camera, and let the actors run around the zoo. Of course he wasn't doing that. He was creating a space in which they could act. And the improvisation was never as much as people said it was. He was looking for that hot laugh, the real moment. And that is in many ways harder to get than telling an actor, I want you to say these lines this way.
Yeah. Paul Newman, who was in Buffalo Bill, said that in one scene, Altman just said two words to him, crowd 'em. and Newman understood what his character was
exactly.
supposed to do.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, Michael Murphy talks about this in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, one of Robert Altman's real masterpieces. He says, "Who is this guy I'm playing?" And Altman just says, "He's somebody's nephew." You immediately get the guy who was just sent out into the hinterland because nobody else wanted this job.
He told Kevin Kline, who plays Guy Noir in Prairie Home Companion, of Guy Noir, Altman said, "He's a nut, you know, he's a nut." And that was the direction. But staying with McCabe and Mrs. Miller, this is, again, the first, pretty much one of the first warts and all Westerns. You know, the hero is not heroic. The heroine, played by Julie Christie, ends up in an opium den. Warren Beatty, who plays McCabe, he's one of those who didn't get it.
No. I'll tell you, of all the people, of the couple of hundred people I talked to, he was the hardest one to convince to talk to me for this book. He was angry at Robert Altman. These guys were like two rams on the side of a mountain butting heads, and he did not like Robert Altman's way of making films.
And he couldn't hear it. I mean, a lot of people come away from an Altman film and say, what did they say? I didn't get it. But Altman told you what? He wanted it to feel like a dinner party?
Exactly, like a dinner conversation or a bar. But you get it, though. If you really think about it, think about McCabe. You know, there are only, seven plots? A Stranger Comes to Town. That's the plot. If you have to hear every line he says, then you're not understanding the bigger image and the bigger issues.
Well, let's listen to a scene. McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
I know it don't mean nothing to you, but I got a reputation in this town. These people...
What's Presbyterian Church to you? You just got to sell out. Got to just sell out and go someplace where people are civilized. They'll get you, McCabe. They'll get you. And they'll do something awful to you.
Okay. Well, also in this era, in this act of Robert Altman's, was Nashville. Pauline Kael, critic Pauline Kael, called it the funniest epic vision of America ever to reach the screen. This had to be one of the biggest dinner parties he ever did. 24 characters.
Yes.
She says, an essay on Nashville and American life. Country fans hated it.
Hated it. They thought it was a big insult because they thought it was supposed to be about country music. And it wasn't at all. It was a way of telling the story about where America was in 1975 and 76. We were sort of celebrating ourselves, but there was this undercurrent, this need for celebrity that now we're, of course, seeing 35 years later come to fruition. He was onto it 35 years ago. Everybody would sell themselves, would give something of themselves up to be famous even for a minute. And ultimately, when the celebrity is shot and assassinated, the wrong person gets assassinated.
A country singer. Yeah.
Yes. And obviously, that predates John Lennon's death by 5 years. We hadn't seen that happen yet. Robert Altman was showing it to us in advance.
Let's listen to a scene from Nashville.
Hey, but listen, I'd be the last guy in the world to try and change your mind about something you don't want to do. But I'd like to explain a couple of things about what we're trying to do in this campaign before you discount it altogether.
And somehow the blood began to drain into behind her eyeball, you know, and the pressure just caused her eye just to bulge out, and it was all red. It was just awful looking. And everybody.
We've made our way, Mitchell, through Act 2, to Act 3 of Robert Altman's life, 1981 to 2006. Here's how you synopsize it. Robert Altman abandons and is abandoned by Hollywood, sells his big studio out in Malibu, films plays, films operas, moves to Paris, gets a new heart, loses a kidney, collects his Oscar, is reborn in a way, embraces his family, goes out with his boots on. This is the era that included The Player, Shortcuts, and, of course, his death.
Hollywood is sick of him. He is sick of Hollywood. He makes Popeye. He goes off to Malta, takes Robin Williams and puts him in his first movie. People don't know what to make of it. People are expecting a Superman kind of comic strip movie, and Robert Altman makes something else. He makes a Robert Altman movie. He keeps finding a way to make his own art, and that in so many ways is his legacy.
What do you think it all adds up to in the end? Is Robert Altman the oversized Hollywood egomaniac who sucked the oxygen out of every room he walked into, like a lot of Hollywood moguls, even though, ironically, he rejected Hollywood mogul life. Someone who left a terrible wake. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of his children, you know, all the problems they had with drugs and alcohol. Or was he the genius who held up a mirror to America and left a legacy of films second to few?
All of the above. And yes, it had effects on his personal life and effects on everything else he did. And in the end, he brought it around, but there was a price to pay.
Well, and he brought a lot of it around, some would say, in Prairie Home Companion. Mm. You were speaking to him near the end of his life. At that point, he knows he's known for a while, but he didn't do a good job with his family. He had some guilt. And there is a scene from Prairie Home Companion One of the women who works on the radio show finds her lover dead in his dressing room, an elderly man, and she's comforted by this angel.
Yes.
Let's listen.
Forgive him his shortcomings and thank him for all of his love and care. Goodbye, baby.
I think Robert Altman is writing his own elegy there, and he was absolutely speaking to the people he loved in his life and also, I think, to the audience. And during the making of Prairie Home Companion, when people suggested this movie was about death, he said, no. But near the end, when I spoke to him a couple weeks before he died, he said, of course it's about death. He didn't want to narrow the focus for everyone else who was going to see other things in it.
Mitchell Zukov, who's written the book, Robert Altman, The Oral Biography, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us about
Thank you, Robin.
And for more on Altman celebrations, and a little later today, we'll post Garrison Keillor reading a poem he wrote for his friend Bob Altman. Go to hereandnow.org. Next week on Here and Now, Jared Diamond on how Haiti might stand again. The latest news is next, Here and Now. A triple murder case stemming from a ghastly home invasion that stunned a bucolic community in Connecticut in 2007 is now going through unusually difficult jury selection because of the horrific nature of the crimes, which, by the way, may be difficult to listen to. 2.5 years ago, Jennifer Hawke Pettit was raped and strangled to death. One of her two daughters was raped. Both girls were then tied up and doused with gasoline. They died as their house was set afire. Their father, Dr. William Pettit, though beaten and bound, was able to flee the home in Cheshire, Connecticut, as it went up in flames. The suspects, Stephen Hayes and Joshua Komisarjevsky, are charged with capital murder, arson, kidnapping, and sexual assault. If convicted of the murder and felony charges, they could face the death penalty. They're being tried separately in Superior Court, and jury selection in the Hayes trial is now into its fourth day, and the going is tough. Aaron Cox is covering the proceedings for WTNH-TV in New Haven. Aaron, let's get right to the controversy. It's over the behind-the-scenes negotiations over the death penalty. Tell us about that.
Well, I think most of the jurors are being directly asked how they feel about the death penalty because in Connecticut, jurors are actually put in the witness box and questioned by prosecutors and defense. And one of the first things they ask them, do you know about this high-profile case, and do you have a feeling about the death penalty?
Yeah, and we understand that they have heard that some plea deals were attempted already.
Well, in the beginning of this case, the attorneys for the defendants said, we're willing to plead guilty if you take the death penalty off the table. Prosecutors won't take the death penalty punishment off the table, and so they're going to go through with the whole trial. And this jury has to decide guilt or innocence first, and then punishment next.
How does that work if they already know that the defendants were willing to plead guilty?
Well, I don't know how many of the jurors are aware of that. I mean, that isn't brought up in the questioning of them. And maybe the attorneys, and this is speculation on my part, are already thinking to what's called the penalty phase. I don't think they're going to seat a jury that would find them not guilty of certain aspects of the crime. So perhaps the defense attorneys are already just thinking, how do I keep these guys off death row? And that's the juror they're looking for.
You spoke to some of the potential jurors who were let go and asked them, you know, how they felt when they realized what case they'd been called in on. Let's listen.
Nervous, because there's a lot of emotional weight that I felt.
I mean, they asked me a lot of questions about the death penalty and stuff, and I don't know. It's kind of a hard decision.
The potential jurors can talk to you after they're dismissed, and a lot of them, you know, as soon as they walk in and they see Dr. William Pettit, the sole survivor, it's sort of this light bulb over their head. You can visibly see it on their face. Oh, my gosh, I could be on this case. You can just sense that in the room.
Yeah. Well, and the accused, we've read a lot of stories about them, both had some traumatic events in their childhood, but then long rap sheets. A lot has been written about how the two accused were given chances to turn their lives around and didn't. The criminal justice system failed, according to the New York Times. So is that a factor here, too?
Well, I think eventually these jurors will find out that these men were parolees. And certainly their life experiences would come into play, not in the guilt or innocence phase, but when this jury might have to determine if they should get life in prison or if they should be put on the death penalty. We should point out these jurors are in the courtroom with Stephen Hayes, this defendant, but he's no longer in a prison jumpsuit. He sits there in a nice striped shirt nice pressed pants, no shackles, no cuffs, but I think they know for sure who he is.
Well, I'm wondering if there's another factor here. The judge in this case, John C. Blue, told prospective jurors that the trial and the penalty phase, which again could start around September, could then last until mid-December. So are people worried about being involved that long with something that is just so emotionally fraught?
I think they're also concerned about their own finances. Many jurors talked about the financial hardship. You know, this would be jury duty for 3 months, if you think about it. And some employers might not be able to cover and pay and maintain a salary, and they're not required to. So the stipend is $50 a day. There was a woman who said, I have a child who's 4, a child who's 2. And the judge said, well, could you sit on the jury? She said, $50 a day won't cover daycare. So she was immediately dismissed.
Erin Cox reporting on the Cheshire murder trial for WTNH-TV in New Haven, Connecticut, as they try to get a jury for this very emotional proceedings. Erin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, looking ahead, has it happened? Has America shifted from its reliance on oil, or is it just that we can't afford it in a recession? We'll take a look at that in 30 seconds, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Is oil so over? Welcome back. Last year, America used 3.5% less gas than the year before, the sharpest drop since 1968. And that shrinking demand is leading to an oil glut. 200 million barrels of oil floating around on tankers, just waiting for someone to buy them. Even the oil behemoth Exxon is now investing in natural gas. So where are we in our love affair with oil? Lisa Marganelli is director of the Energy Policy Initiative at the New America Foundation, a progressive think tank. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you.
And in a recent Atlantic web article, you say we're in a much different place than we were just a decade ago when it comes to oil. So remind us, take us through the decade.
Okay, well, back in 2000 or in 1999, we had oil prices were at their absolute lowest that anyone could even imagine, $9 a barrel, which is so low. It costs quite a bit to get oil out of the ground. So some countries were actually running at a deficit getting the stuff out for us. And there seemed to be no end to the oil in sight. An article was written in Foreign Policy magazine that worried about the beginning of the age of too cheap oil. They worried that the oil would be $7 a barrel, and then who would want to produce it?
And by the way, Lisa, why were they charging so little? You said maybe some countries even in a deficit to sell us oil. Why wouldn't they just raise the price?
Well, they can't raise the price. Prices are determined in sort of a delicate dance between producers and consumers. And after the Asian economy's sort of recession in the mid-90s, demand went way down, but still there was lots more oil coming online from Russia. It just seemed like the whole place was just floating in oil.
Right.
Things didn't really change until there was a strike in Venezuela that sent prices up. There was also the invasion of Iraq. And then, by the summer of 2008, my goodness, we had oil at $145 a barrel.
Well, you also note that the way oil is bought and sold has changed. Something called machine trading has affected oil prices. How so?
Oh, okay. Well, to talk about this, we need to talk about the price of crude oil in the world oil market. And a lot of the price is actually set in New York at a place called the NYMEX, the New York Mercantile Exchange. People buy and sell options to buy oil in the future. It was started as a way of hedging. So, for example, if I'm a refinery and I don't want to buy oil at a different price every day, I can buy some in advance at kind of an advance price, and that will kind of cushion the ups and downs of the daily prices because I'll be able to plan. And what's happened over the years is that it's become a place where speculators trade, where hedge funds trade, and they buy and sell oil to make some profit on these swings up and down. And at the same time, some very large banks have started doing what's called machine trading. Basically, they have computers doing trades all night long, and sometimes it's computers responding to other computers. And so you have some different behavior in the oil market than you had before, plus you have different traders in the oil market.
You say machine trading is much more sensitive to really small changes. For example, you give the example of a rebel in Nigeria calling up a reporter to say he's going to attack something.
Right. there was a rebel commander in Nigeria. He was involved in peace talks. He didn't like the way they were going. He stepped out of the peace talks and he called a Reuters reporter on his cell phone and said, I'm going to take down one of these flow stations. And the Reuters reporter did exactly what he was supposed to do. He typed that right out onto the wire. That went directly to the NYMEX oil market. And immediately the price went up to $50 a barrel, a big jump, though I think one of the largest one-day jumps ever, maybe $5. But in fact, he was really only threatening 30,000 barrels of oil, which is nothing when the world is trading, as it was at the time, something like 98 million barrels of oil a day. So it was nothing. But his potency was magnified by telecommunications, by the media, and by the market itself.
And so in 2008, $145 a barrel, as you said. And bring us to today.
Well, we hit $145 a barrel, and everyone just pretty much freaked out. You mentioned that gasoline demand fell 3.5% in the past year. What's more incredible is that diesel demand fell 6.5% in the past year, which means that all these trucks are not trucking things around. They're not trucking around the baby lettuce. They're not trucking chairs that come from China, from the ports all the way inland. They're not trucking for Walmart. They're just not trucking. A lot of stuff is just not moving. In the bigger picture, this is a really interesting time for this to happen because we're starting to look at really taking climate change seriously and starting to limit the amount of carbon that we put into the atmosphere.
Well, I just want to underscore more. You know, the other story that sort of runs right alongside the oil story is, of course, global warming. And for a long time, it was a huge debate. Now, much less of a debate. You write, even climate deniers like Exxon have come out in favor of limiting carbon emissions. So might that drop we've seen in the last couple of years also be people maybe thinking consciously about when they get in their cars, or no?
I think some of it is people thinking consciously about when they get in their cars. Some of it is people consciously deciding that they're going to get a smaller car or they're only going to drive their smaller car and they leave the bigger car in the yard. So if we can keep demand down and we can start having cars with better fuel mileage, electric cars in some parts of the country, maybe natural gas vehicles, we're going to start seeing this slow shift away from being the oil people that we are.
Well, meanwhile, you picked up on something that might be a metaphor for that switch at gas stations, where it was once all about, you know, raw power, the tiger in the tank. The stickers are now about energy consumption. And at the counters, power bars have given away to energy bars and drinks.
Right. Some of the weirder products are, for example, energy jerky, which is
caffeinated,
you know, dried
beef jerky.
Beef with caffeine. There's just this sort of really weird, kooky bunch of caffeinated products. One of them is called Perky Jerky. And, you know, perhaps we are starting to think about energy rather than just pure power, and the classic sort of V6 and V8 American cars are gradually changing to something that's more energy efficient and more about using the least energy to get us where we need to go.
That's Lisa Marganelli, director of the Energy Policy Initiative at the New America Foundation, a progressive think tank. She's been speaking to us from Oakland, California, about oil. And I just want to mention further that you end your article in The Atlantic online with just, as you say, apropos of nothing, you have a link to how you can use a Slim Jim and a cucumber to cut through metal. Can you really?
You can in the YouTube video. You're basically burning the fat, and I think that the cucumber acts as kind of an insulator and a way of focusing the flame. They show someone cutting through a very thin metal tray.
Well, we will have that at our website, hereandnow.org. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. 33 states, plus Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C., have banned smoking in public areas, restaurants, bars, workplaces. Ashtrays in cars are a thing of the past. So are smoking stands, those one-dimensional wooden cutouts of butlers or cartoon characters like Betty Boop holding out a tray, silent servants for smokers. Well, Joel Neuschatz collects these arts and crafts artifacts. He's now co-authored a book about them called Vintage Smoking Stands. We have a sampling of pictures at our website, hereandnow.org. You can check them out. But Joel, as I look at the book, I see these fascinating figures. There's Popeye, there's a sailor, a Native American. What got you into this?
it was kind of love at first sight. I had a friend who married a woman in the antique business, and they used to visit our home and go on buying trips. And we would canvas the back roads of New England. And I saw one, and it was irresistible. And then the next one came along, and the rest is history, and a big collection resulted.
How did they originate?
We really have delved deeply into this because there was really no history on this that we could uncover. So we dug deep and far, speaking to collectors and dealers, and the best that we can understand is that these were made principally in the 1920s and 1930s, and they were done in home environments, sometimes in schools and shop classes, and sometimes in places like settlement houses or YMCAs. It was a different world then. It was the Depression. People kind of emphasized these kinds of skills to a greater degree than we do today.
Well, and they weren't just for cigarette smokers. You could put playing cards on them. They served different purposes, and they had different names. What were some of the names?
Different people called them different things. Smoking stands, we accepted as the most common designation, but smoke stands, silent butlers, tip collectors, card holders, the list goes on and on.
Right.
I really believe initially they were meant as ashtrays, but as we spoke about, since smoking has kind of gone out of fashion, now when they're around, you can find them in businesses holding business cards. I hate to admit, we keep them in our bathrooms with an extra roll of toilet paper on them. the guests always have a comment about that. So they can be adapted to all kinds of means.
Hey, if you can't have a butler, have a wooden one-dimensional version.
The next best thing.
Or bellhop. Some of them would be seen today as being politically incorrect, because they seem to be black servants in particular.
That's a very sensitive point for us. And yes, about half of these are African-American or black figures, often in servile roles as butlers and waiters and the like. But first of all, it's history. These are 75, 80 years old, and these are artifacts of the times. And the black collectible movement is alive and well and growing. And many people who collect black memorabilia are African-Americans
right.
themselves to document the history of this.
Well, and we should point out that there are other figures depicted in these smoking stands that other populations might either want to collect as part of their history or see as insulting. There's many Asians, for instance, in the smoking stand cutouts.
Absolutely. We've tried to categorize these, and there's a category that we kind of called the exotics. And they're Asians and Middle Eastern types and kind of undefined racial and ethnic varieties.
Do we know who some of these artists are? I'm looking at patents that you have from the U.S. Patent Office.
They're unknown artists. Occasionally they're initialed. On a rare occasion they're signed. But again, these weren't made by artists. These were made by everyday people working in their homes as hobbyists. So they weren't intended to be art or to be sold or to be identified. In that sense, they fall in the category of outsider art.
So now you have these things that are remnants of a long ago past. Someday, you know, there's going to be Zippo collections. And someone will say, what were those for?
The arc of collectability just goes on forever. Pez dispensers today, and on it goes. But we think that these are different. We think these really have genuine artistic merit and tell quite a sociologic story also. They really reflect the times of the Depression and the war. There are military figures who just look wonderful here, and they were done because the country was at war and the military was highly respected then.
That's Joel Neuschatz, co-author of Vintage Smoking Stands, a collection of pictures of these antiques. Joel, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Well, before we go, football, ice skating, tennis. There's no need to leave your home this weekend. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, joins us with a preview of the sports this weekend. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And let's go to the football conference championships first. I guess the question is whether the New York Jets' Cinderella ride will stop in Indianapolis when they meet Peyton Manning, fresh off his Chinese ping pong match with Justin Timberlake. I love that commercial.
It just gets better and better on TV. Why leave your home, even if there isn't sports?
Right, right. So the commercials can do it. If you will see Peyton Manning there. But he also apparently leads the Colts. So do you think the Jets have a chance of upending the Colts?
Oh, there are so many wonderful subplots to this. It's Jets-Colts redux, as long as you kind of, you know, suspend disbelief and don't remember the Colts used to play in Baltimore. So far as I know, Jets quarterback Mark Sanchez has yet to guarantee a victory, a la Joe Namath in Super Bowl III, played back when Hector was a pup. or something like that. But it should be fun. It should be great fun. And as you say, it is sort of a long-shot Jets team, and everybody favors Peyton Manning, but that's why they play the games.
Well, and the Jets have won 7 of their last 8 games.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They deserve to be there, no question about it.
With their tremendous rushing. Well, later tomorrow, the Minnesota Vikings travel to New Orleans to meet the Saints. We'll see the league's 2 highest-scoring teams in that game. And 2 of the NFL's best quarterbacks, the Vikings' Brett Favre and the Saints' Drew Brees. Your thoughts?
Well, if New Orleans can get to Brett Favre a couple of times early and have him thinking, I'm really too old for this nonsense. He's not really 75, but he is really 40. But he had a great week last week through 4 touchdown passes. The great advantage that New Orleans will have is that they're playing at home in the noisiest building that ever hosts football.
It
may be very distracting for Brett Favre to know that his teammates can't hear what he's saying back there.
When he's calling audibles.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Going in, the Saints are 6-2 at home, Vikings 4-4 on the road this year. Let's switch to tennis, the Australian Tennis Open. That's why a lot of us are very tired. Top seeds Roger Federer and Serena Williams rolling along. They're defending their Australian titles, but there have been some surprises.
Well, there have been some surprises, perhaps among the great ones, Justine Henin, who is back playing tennis. She took some time off. She got divorced. She did lots of things other than play tennis. She said she discovered tennis wasn't the most important thing in the world, and then she decided to come back. And she's come back with something of a rush. She's beating everybody that she has to beat.
Yep. And then there's Kim Clijsters, though.
Yeah, not unhappily such a pleasant story. She took 52 minutes to lose her match the other night.
So there went Kim Clijsters and wasn't too happy about it. Well, look at the time. And I know you all did this on purpose. No time left to talk about figure skating, which I'll be watching, except to say the women's finals are tomorrow in Spokane, Washington. A lot of very young contenders, and then...
Yeah, again, an interesting story. Sasha Cohen at the advanced age of 25, returning to the spotlight, and it will be interesting to see whether she can finish number one again.
Right. She was a 2006 silver medalist. Well, but as we said, no more time for figure skating, my sport, except to say there was a kerfuffle over a Russian pair skaters had an aboriginal-themed costume, and then everyone, I guess, was happy that one of the male skaters in these Olympic trials stopped dressing like a magpie.
That's always good news.
Yeah, there you go. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program Only a Game. Be sure to catch that this weekend. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Public Radio International.